All right, welcome to episode number 86. Our guest is Dan Huff. I've been trying to get on for a long time. I told you, because we were in New York together. How long ago was that? A month ago?
I feel like a month, yeah.
Thomas Rhett. And by the way, Dan Huff, I'm going to go through a lot of his stuff through the next bit of time. But of everyone that was in New York, it was Thomas, who I'm friends with, Thomas Rhett, and a lot of other producers. But I was like, Dan, can we take a picture together? Like, you were the one guy that I geeked out over. Because, man, you have done so much. Like, I look at this, and I always like to run down the roster of things real quick. Albums that he produced, first of all. 9 of Rascal Flatts' 11 albums. Keith Urban's last 7 records on that. Thomas Rhett, Life Changes, Entangled Up. Taylor Swift, Red, produced 3 songs on that. Lone Star, Carrie Underwood, Some Hearts. I mean, I could go on. Songs to play guitar on. Madonna, Like a Prayer. Paula Abdul, Straight Up. Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror. There's a lot, and I want to get to a lot of that, but first of all, I'm just a big fan, so I'm glad that you're
Thank
able
you.
To come in.
Thanks. It was the significant part of that picture that you took was that my son-in-law, Jordan, who is a rabid fan of yours. I think he was impressed for the first time.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, in his father-in-law. So that was a big deal. Yeah, you must have put that on Instagram.
I did.
He follows you, and it was like extremely validated at that moment. So I appreciate that.
Eddie is a music nerd, too. So he's sitting in as well because he was like, Dan Huff's coming in. Can I talk to him? So Eddie's in here, too. So
no, I appreciate it. Bobby never lets me sit in on any of these. So
never.
Man, I'm a fan, and I just want to listen to everything you have to say right now.
Oh. How about, I told you I was watching you on YouTube, and this is an old video on YouTube of you just shredding and like teaching. Do you remember making this video?
I do. It was right down here on the row in what was Quad Studios, I think.
What year did you make this video?
It had to be in the 90s. Somewhere in the 90s.
I mean, he's crushing it. I mean, it's a it's a masterclass in just watching someone play guitar. And then I want to start with some of the songs. Like, you played guitar on Like a Virgin with Madonna?
No, not Like a Virgin.
Wait, what's this one? No, not...
Like a Prayer.
Like a Prayer. Yeah. All I saw was Like up here. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You played guitar on this song?
If the credits say so. There was so much. The 80s were a blur to me. Not because of any extracurricular activities. As a matter of fact, I'm from Nashville. When I moved out there, I was as green as you possibly can get. So when I got out there, I was in awe of the situation. There was so much of this stuff that went on that it was just like day-to-day stuff. You know, for me, like, for instance, you mentioned that Straight Up track by Paula Abdul. I was in London recording a Giant record with my brother, which was the band you played a minute ago. And we were we were in an airport, either in the airport or in the hotel, saw this song. And I commented something about the guitar part. I liked the wah-wah guitar part.
What do you mean you saw the song?
Well, it was on a video at this point.
Okay.
And I said, that's a cool guitar part. And my brother, David, looked at me like, well, he's smiling. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you played on that.
Oh, you saw the video and didn't realize that.
I forgot. I had forgotten. And I had actually forgotten to file a union contract, too. So I hadn't gotten paid for the thing. And it was already on a video at that point. Isn't that?
And you were a fan of yourself, which is always a great thing.
Which says a lot about me. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me say. And you don't remember playing that song?
Well, after Paula wasn't there, and I did after I heard it, after my brother kind of shamed me, I did remember the session. She wasn't there. I don't think there were any vocals on it at that point. I was just working with a producer in some West Hollywood studio. Yeah, that was it.
So how do you go from Nashville to LA? Like, are you crushing it so much as a guitarist where you start to be known and they're like, hey, because people get in demand real quick.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, oh, this is a hot person. Were you that super hot guitar player at that period of time?
No. That's why I moved. I mean, I grew up here in Nashville. And the irony of the fact that I produce country records right now is not lost on the fact I never listened to country music until I was 30 years old. And I was a rock fan. I was a pop fan. And that's what I wanted to do. So there was a bass player that I started doing some sessions with here in Nashville, a guy named David Hungate, who's kind of legendary in the session world. He was in a band called Toto.
I know Toto.
Yeah. I mean, that was
Africa.
Yes. And yeah. that was like these were the super group of musicians in LA. They played on all the records that I grew up listening to. And he said, if you really want to make it, you got to go out to LA and make it as a guitar player. And remember, this is in the late 70s, early 80s. And he was right. And through a series of events that happened, no, I was not an in-demand guitar player in Nashville. I was a fringe guitar player, played too many notes, as you evidenced on that one, the video. But and it wasn't the right timing for Nashville. Nashville didn't feed on youth at that point. L.A. did. And I got out there through a bizarre series of events, and it started snowballing at that point.
So do you get more, because this song held the record until Sam Hunt took it, but like One Sweet Day, Mariah Carey, Boys to Men, and you played on this.
Yeah, I played on a bunch of Mariah stuff at different, Walter Afanasyev was a good friend of mine. So
if a song is more successful and you're a player on it, do you make more money, or is it like a one-time thing?
Well, back then it was pretty much a one-time thing. It was, you know, you got paid. I played for double scale. Now, that was going from demo scale in Nashville to double scale. It was like
a... What a scale means, what a person in the union gets.
Yeah, and I would charge. I was told out there by the musicians who I kind of got in with immediately, you know, don't make us look bad, charge what we're charging, which was double scale. So, I mean, for 3 hours, and you break your day up in three-hour increments, it was a great living for a 22-year-old kid.
And
I mean,
so,
it was a lot of money.
Well, you recorded this again out without the artists.
What? Sometimes, like there was, you know, like this guy that I worked with, Walter Afanasyev. He would just hire me on just tons of stuff. A lot of times the vocals were on there. I remember one time we did my Voice Will Go On, the theme from, what's the movie?
Oh, My Heart Will Go On, Titanic.
Yeah.
And you play guitar on this.
Yeah. Just ironic that you have those. The vocal wasn't on it. We actually did that after I moved back to Nashville at a studio down the street.
So how do they call you and they go, do they tell you it's a Titanic song, or do they just say, hey, we're going to send you a sheet of paper with all the, I don't even know what language that is that you guys read. Yeah. How does that work?
It's any and everything you can imagine.
So you just go into a studio with
music. They just play music and you just start jamming with it. I mean, I was a horrible reader. I grew up being a guitar player. Your education musically is somehow stunted because you're a narcissist. Number one, you're a guitar player. You want to shred and you want girls to look at you. And for some reason, I didn't get the reading memo. So I was always pretty remedial in reading, but I can hear a song once and know it pretty much. So usually what they would do is just play a track and say, you know, play what you feel. Or if they hear a line, maybe play this or something like that.
At what point in your life could you start to play things back? Because that's something that's kind of ingrained into you.
I grew up wanting, I was the opposite of young guitar players, wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to be a studio player. I thought that was the coolest thing. So I grew up in Nashville. My father was in Christian, contemporary Christian music. He was an orchestrator. And so I'd go to all the sessions with him when I was, you know, started 13 years old. And that's, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world.
So you saw sessions, because a lot of people, what they see is the rock and roll on stage.
Yes.
So you actually saw sessions and thought that would be cool.
I thought those musicians were the best, because what they could do is sight on you know, basically on site at that moment, they could create something that didn't exist before that moment.
And it's wild that you played on all these songs.
So like you know what? I think, Bobby, too, I think sometimes, I mean, somebody told me that the Wikipedia page on me is quite extensive. I've never really looked at it.
I
glanced at it for 2 seconds and it looked like, really? I don't know who keeps all these stats. I think some of them are right. I think some of them are wrong. I don't know how I get, I mean, I played with all these artists, but as far as per song, some of them I can't remember, to be honest.
So what about this one here? This is a pretty legendary one. Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror.
Yeah, played on that one.
Now that one you do remember.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, I remember most of them, but that one especially, yeah, that was a pretty big deal. I was 20, I don't know what year that record was recorded in. I'm assuming I was about 24, 25.
Now, did you know it was a Michael Jackson song?
Oh, yeah. Did you? I mean, I got called in. I mean, that wasn't lost on me. I mean, I got, you know, you kind of knew you had made it when you got a call from Quincy Jones. And, you know, I knew Michael Jackson was. And I remember going in the first day. The first session I worked on with him was not that song. It was a song. It was his leadoff single, which is, I can't remember the name of it. It was like a ballad. He would release a ballad first. And I was just in awe. I mean, I walked into the studio and it was bizarre. Did I tell you this the other night in New York? Somebody asked me about this. I walked into Westlake Studio and basically you walk in an alleyway and it opens up right into a lounge and there's a bathroom right in front of you. And I walked in and I saw this what looked like a pretty raggedy. I hate to say it like this, but it's like a street person. I mean, a really unkept person in the bathroom being attended to by somebody. And that was my first inclination of to kind of, you kind of look at it and go, okay, well, I'm just going to kind of mosey on down the hallway. And the person that was attending to this person then all of a sudden pulled off the hair, and it was a wig. It was Michael Jackson.
Oh, wow.
In Hollywood quality garb to make him be able to blend in to like walk down Melrose
Avenue. Oh, so what he was wearing was to fake people out so they wouldn't know it was Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And you saw him peeling off the disguise.
It looked a little uncomfortable. All of a sudden, there's no hair, and it's like nobody screamed. So I looked back, and I realized that it was him. And I'd never met him, and I asked him, you know, I mean, it seems pretty obvious now, but at that moment, it was kind of surreal. And he articulated that that's the way he could walk down the street, which I thought was pretty interesting.
So did you spend much time with him in studio, and did he have any production? Like, was he like, hey, do some more of this? Was he hands-on, even though Quincy, you know?
He was present. Yeah, I mean, they to be invited to that kind of setting, the bar is pretty high. I mean, all the musicians are kind of the musicians, you know? And they're pretty loose about it. I mean, they hire whoever they want. So they get people they think are going to do the job and add to their music. And they pretty loose reins. They let you kind of do what you do. And they'll weigh in. I remember Michael would walk around and ask questions about some equipment. And, you know, just very hospitable, kind of friendly guy.
That one make you nervous?
I was definitely nervous.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, this is in the session world, it's – you're pretty much only as good as your last session, you know, and as long as you keep playing good and I wasn't aware what hit records. I was pretty naive back then. All I cared about was just being invited and playing. I cared about guitar, you know, that was it. But when you get invited there, if you do a good job, you get asked back. And that's why I got asked back to do that Man in the Mirror song.
That's crazy. Like, yeah. That's a generational song.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
A lot of all those are like Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On.
Yeah.
Like those are.
It doesn't feel like that when you're going through it, though. It's. I mean, every day, like, you know, there'd be this session, and then the next day might be doing like Pepsi Cola jingle, and then a movie or a TV soundtrack, and then, you know, I mean, just and then a lot of international music. I mean, LA was a hub for just everything in the recording in the 80s. As it turned out, I left in 90, right at or 89, and that was really the end of the golden years. I think the 70s were the true golden years in LA. I missed it by a decade, you know, but it was still really healthy. And I moved back to Nashville because we had this band and I want to raise my kids here. My family, my extended family was here, and didn't realize that I kind of just got out right under the radar, you know?
Wow. I'm going to talk about Sleep Number for 1 second. So it's fall now, as you hear my voice, life is fally. I mean, it's like summer vacation's over and kids are back in school and it's like time to get everything in before the holidays. So you need that best quality sleep. So when you go to work, you're feeling good. And to be the best, you need a good bed. The Sleep Number bed lets you choose your ideal comfort, your support on each side. It's the perfect bed for couples because you can do it on each side, as I'm talking about. Their newest beds are so smart, they actually sense your every move and automatically adjust so that you stay sleeping comfortably through the night. There's even a snoring adjustment. There's so much to this bed that's awesome. My Sleep Number setting is 30. My Sleep IQ score last night was in the 90s. Right now, Sleep Number beds cost about the same as traditional mattresses and last twice as long. Over 90% of owners recommend it, and right now up to $600 off, special financing, free home delivery. This ends soon, though. You only find the Sleep Number at one of the 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide and sleepnumber.com. And when you go, you call them up, you get a store, whatever, tell them Bobby Bones sent you. Okay, so you talk about your band, Giant.
That was my departure into singing for a few minutes.
Look at this guy. This is you.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it felt every night, too.
Ouch. That's such a big song. Like, in the way of, like, vocally. Like, that's a large song.
Yeah.
I'll see you.
Yeah, it hurt. Every night. I didn't grow up wanting to be a singer, especially not in a rock band.
And so how did you end up being the singer of your band?
Oh. You got time for this? I'll try to. Let me see if I can.
No, tell me. We got plenty of time. Tell me the story.
It was just one of those things, you know, you're kind of on the fast track and you're recording with a lot of rock bands and a lot of pop artists. And through that journey, you kind of see, you know, there are very few what I would say would be transcendent artists. Most people, it's a business, right? And you sit there and you kind of develop this, I would say it would be an, you know, certain ego sense. God, if these guys can do this, I can do this. So we started a practice band out at, I remember it was REO. Remember the rock band, REO Speedwagon?
Yeah,
they had a rehearsal space. So a bunch of us got together. There were a couple songwriters who were the singers and a bunch of studio musicians. And we started just kind of writing songs and kind of a Toto-esque situation again. And it...
And Toto-esque, you mean two singers?
Toto-esque meaning singers? Studio musicians.
Okay.
Not a bunch of pretty dudes. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it was, we were musically proficient. I'd say on the live side, on the presentation, we were probably pretty lacking. One of the singers was Tom Kelly. And he was a great singer. Tommy Funderburk sang on all the hit records. He was a backup singer. Tom Kelly, the same thing. Tom Kelly, I remember one day, brought in a song. He said he wanted us to work it up, and it was a song that he wrote, and they were getting this young girl, Madonna, was going to record it. It was called Like a Virgin. And I just remember, we were all sitting there going like, we ain't going to work this song up. This is not I'm not going to sit there and sing Like a Virgin. And you know, and obviously we know what happened to the song, and Tom is a great writer. That is basically, I'm fast forwarding because this gets really boring. One of the guys in the band and I, Alan Pasqua, we said, why don't we try this on our own? Invited my brother David out. Mike Brignardello was a session stalwart here in Nashville. And I said, I'll sing. And so we started writing songs, and that was it. And I started singing and kind of learning. And I had a bunch of cool people help me out. I had a range, but I had no control. I was working a lot with Michael Bolton then. Michael gave me some tips, which is kind of interesting.
What tips? Because Michael, a great vocalist with a very wide range.
Oh,
like, what does he say to you? Like, what's his tips to learn to sing?
It was all breath support, you know, I mean, none of which I ever accomplished to that level. I mean, it was like, he'd make it look easy. He was like, yeah, just do this. Right. You know, but it kind of firmed up. He said, you know, he said, sing from here, do this when you go for the high notes. And so I kind of eked my way through, and we did some demos, got signed by A&M Records. It was bizarre. So this kid who was a studio player, all of a sudden we're out there on the road playing, you know, and I just realized this was in the middle of the 80s, bands like Poison, Whitesnake, you know, all these bands were doing it. And if you looked at them, you look at us, there was something definitely missing. And it was, you know, the commitment to that thing. You know, we liked the music, but the rest of it wasn't there for us.
Look at this guy.
We just did a 27 years later, 2 months ago, we did a, what I swore we'd never do. We played together again. And, you know, people have been asking us over in Europe. We did pretty good in Europe. And it's, for me, those days are gone, right? I mean, look at my hair. You know, it's like, I couldn't fit into the spandex, you know. But a local musician, his house was burned down. And he was apparently a fan. And so I had no excuse because... Mike Brignardello, the bass player in our band, said that there was a guy, Brian Cole from Pittsburgh, who's a rock singer. He said he's a huge fan. He'd come down and sing the songs. Because I said, I'm not trying to sing that again. It's been 27 years. I'd sound like a... I tried it. I will say this. I tried it in my studio at the house, and it was laughable. I said, there's not a chance. No excuse. And so we actually got together and played the other night. Where did we play? I can't remember which club. But we played. It was fun.
Was it fun?
It was great. I was hoping to land. I started it with like a minute and a half guitar solo, like kind of in the days of yore. And I thought either I land this or I look like a fool. And, you know, of course, everybody's filming it, you know, on their phones. Landed it. That's all I cared about. We got through it. It was the reunion farewell tour within 15 minutes. That was it.
Wow. That's fun.
Yeah.
So when does Giant stop?
Giant stopped when I saw Even Flow by Pearl Jam. I saw that guy. We were in New York finishing our second record. And I saw this video. Somebody innocently played me Eddie Vedder, and I thought, "Well, that ain't me, and I can't do that." Do you remember that? Do you remember that? No, you're too young.
And he's a diehard Pearl Jam fan. That's his favorite band ever.
That's my favorite band.
Do you remember
all time.
Even Flow, the first video when he was in that little theater climbing up into the balcony?
He climbs all the way to the side, and then he lets himself go to let the crowd catch him on his back.
I mean, that's commitment, and that was something that I knew I didn't have that in me. And music was changing. We were the end of the 80s, you know, and it was just like, this ain't going to happen. We kind of limped for another year. I still kept my studio career going. And then during that time, you know, we just moved back to Nashville. And James Stroud, who was kind of a legendary producer at that time, like, he's still legendary, but at that time he was doing, I don't know, 20, 30 records a year. It was something I can't process. And he asked me to play on all of his records. And I said, well, I don't know how to play country music. He said, doesn't matter. Just play how you play. I'm going to incorporate that in. And that was kind of during that era when country music started incorporating more rock and pop values.
So when you come over and it's, you say that era, like what was that you can think back to, like the big artist or the big record that you worked on first where you're like, okay, this might work because there was some success to it?
John Anderson. That was, he had this record called Seminole Wind.
Yeah.
And it.
No, well.
And it's funny, it's one of those records, it's like kind of old school. We got a band and then we probably cut the whole record in 3 days. And it was just magical. And then, you know, and then James was doing Clint Black and he invited me to play on some of that stuff. And, you know, it's the same thing that happened in Los Angeles. Word of mouth, you know, if you play on a hit, everybody wants that new thing, whatever that, that you know, unquantifiable thing that gives them that hit status or whatever. So if you're lucky enough to do it and you're consistent enough, you know, it kind of starts rolling. So I got back into the session world again, playing in country music. And the learning curve was steep because I knew that I was, when you had people like Brent Mason running around Nashville at that time, I mean, this guy is a legend and a guitar god in my mind. But there was a place for me in my kind of rock background to do it. And we worked well. And I mean, I would do 2 and 3 sessions a day.
So as you're doing those, you're doing 3 sessions. Mm-hmm. You're talking about 9 hours of playing mm-hmm. with time to travel in between. And
well, it's
eat.
Just down here in Music Row, so it's not a big deal.
So if you get that, because it's like 9 to noon most of the time, right?
Well, back then it was 10 to 1, 2 to 5, and then 6 to 9.
And you would play 3 sessions some days.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes 4.
Would you? Wow.
Yeah, I was greedy.
Would you prepare for each session, or were you so strong in your own mind that you could walk in and pretty much catch it?
No, nobody. There was no prep.
Oh, you didn't. The night before, you didn't go over notes.
No. You didn't hear the songs until you walked into the studio. That's the beauty. I mean, you know, this happens every day here in town. Still, you know, you come in and teams are kind of put together and you hear this music for the first time. There's very seldom any kind of tapes being passed around before the session. You just react to it.
Wow.
So yeah, yeah.
So you move to town and you're playing, but when do you make that transition to go, hey, listen, I can, like, I'm a great player, but I want to be the guy that actually controls all the sounds. I want to be the producer.
I didn't make that decision. It was. And I guess this would be near the mid or the end of the 90s. And I think I told you this the other night. It was Mutt Lange, ironically. I mean, just my whole foray into country music, it's just bizarre how it happened, bizarre when it happened. And then kind of getting that push out of the nest of a player, I was working on the Shania records with him. And he had told me, by the way, I had done some other records with him over in London. And he told me he was dating this girl named Shania Twain. Had I heard of her? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'm going to do a record on her. And I said, that's cool. And he said, I'm not going to use you, though. And I said, why? Because I was playing, I can't remember the artist I was playing on at that moment. But he said, well, because you're not a country guitar player, you don't know how to do that. And he was right. He was so right. And then all I remember, and I kind of felt a little bit bad. It's like, you know, come on, give me a shot. I'm playing on all these other country records. But he, being this rock super producer, I mean, this guy is in the status that none of us will ever achieve, you know. But he was right. He knew it. He understood. I wasn't a country guitar player. There's no way. 2 days into the track, and I got this phone call. He said, hey, Danny, can you mind coming down and giving it a play? That's what he said. And I said, what happened? You know, he said, well, I mean, this was a big compliment for me. He said, I need your wrist, the way that you articulate a certain kind of rhythm. And the first song that I remember going and playing was Any Man of Mine. It was kind of trippy. And so anyway, that went on for a while. And a lot of time spent with him. I learned so much from being around him as I did these other producers. And he told me, he said, you're a producer.
What was his thing? Like, why is he that genius that he is?
Oh, man,
like, what is it about him that made him special?
He's a great songwriter, number one, which I'm not. I mean, he's a great songwriter. He gets to the essence of a song. He knows what it is, whether it was AC/DC or Shania Twain or anything in between. He just gets it. He's the most unassuming person. You walk in here, you wouldn't know it was him. He used to write around when he would come to Nashville. I mean, this is a guy who, number one, when he moves to a country, they negotiate his tax status. It's bizarre. I mean, this guy's worth quite a bit. Never wears his wealth, which I so respect. He would ride a bike around Music Row, you know, strap a guitar on his back, wear sandals, and that was him. He has this ability to, he has an innate respect for humans. So he never makes you feel less. He knows how to, lead. He knows how to, bring out stuff in players. He would work with bands that they didn't know they had. And so when he would work with studio musicians, that was kind of a treat for him, but he would do the same thing. And you just had to buy into the fact that he was hearing something and he was listening for something, if, as long as your ego wouldn't get too involved, because you would do it over and over again. You'd sit and play a little ding, 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 ding part for maybe 3 hours at a time.
Would you ever go, I just nailed that?
No, I actually knew what he was talking about. Yeah. I could hear it. He kind of hears in slow motion. He wants every note of every song to be the greatest. And I don't know that philosophically that I'm at 100% down with that. I like a little bit more around the edges. I've been affected by some other music that I like a balance between it. But I understood it. But he also heard the way that I was hearing. And then I think that's why he said, you need to do this. And it was a shock to me.
So then how do you do it the first time? Who takes the risk on old Danny Huff, the guy that's never produced a record?
Well, it's a little tough because of the way that the music situation was set up here in Nashville. You know, there's a hierarchy. There's a way things are done. You've got your producers, you've got your publishers, you know, your labels, and your musicians. Where, you know, your audience can't see my tear, but when I say musicians, it's down near the bottom. And respected, but everybody kind of does their gig, you know, and you didn't poke your head too much out of your class and what you're doing. And so anyway, to back up, because of my rock music background, there was a chance to produce Megadeth. They were kind of near the end of their days, and Megadeth came down here. I started producing them.
Listen to this.
That's so funny. Is that Cryptic Writings?
It is. Listen to this. Yeah.
That was recorded in Nashville.
Look at that.
You're way on top of it, Bobby.
Yeah, go on. I'm listening to Megadeth. Go on.
So at the same time, Faith Hill was changing her producer, and she and Shania were friends, and I guess they were all hanging out. And I think it was Mudd who just said, hey, why don't you try your guitar player? And I had played on a bunch of Faith's records at that point. And, you know, that just wasn't done. So she took a chance. She used Tim's producer, Byron Gallimore, who is a longtime friend of mine. I used to play tons of records for Byron. And so I got that was kind of my break. But ironically, in Nashville, I mean, I remember hearing, you know, you'd go to the publishing companies, and back then, you know, back then the producers were the ones who were listening to the songs for the artist, very much different than it is now. And I remember, you know, I'd played on all these hit songs, but when I was listening to songs from these publishers, they were really bad. And I didn't realize until later that they're giving me their third drawer songs.
That you weren't even getting the high.
Oh, no.
They were going to the big dogs first.
Totally. I mean, it's like, come on, your guitar player. I remember hearing one A&R guy say, anybody can produce a hit song of Faith Hill, which... there's some truth to that. I mean, it hurt to hear it. I mean, I think I did good on that song. That was a song. There's a song called Let Me Let Go that really kind of pushed me up in my career at that point. But it took a while, and it actually took a young tape copy guy back. This is in the day when there were actually tapes involved. These weren't MP3s. And he was in the tape copy room in Alamo, and he was friends. His name is Daryl Franklin. And he was friends with a lot of the writers. And he figured a way to circumvent the system. And he handed me some of their songs. And there was a young writer at that point who was pretty undiscovered named Jeff Steele, who ended up writing, you know, I mean, I can't enumerate how many massive hits this guy has written. I was lucky to form a relationship with him early, and that's how I got the songs. And, you know, it's how everybody breaks in. You have to bend the rules, and it takes a lot of people. So it wasn't all me, but I delivered the goods, and one thing led to the next, and then I got asked to produce this band who I think was getting ready to get cut from RCA at that time, named Lone Star. I don't know how you do what you have. We done this before?
We,
this is so...
we haven't. Hey, I'm doing a little producing myself over here. You know what I'm saying?
This is something.
You gotta let me do a little producing over here.
There is no script here.
There's no script, yeah.
No, this is bizarre. Yeah. And I'll give you the other side of that. I thought another song on the record was the big hit. So, I mean, this, you know, nobody knows this stuff. And I put all the money and all the time in this other song. When they released it, it almost tanked their career. And it wasn't because, it was because Joe Galani, who was running that label at that time, had the foresight. He had some other people listening to the song. He flipped the first single in the middle of the first single. I can't remember what this other song was called, but... you know, so that ended up totally validating me. All of a sudden, I'm this, you know, I mean, I'm the new genius, right? The new genius didn't even know that was a hit song.
And that crossed over hard.
Oh, it was huge.
I mean, not just country. That crossed over into like mainstream America, pop world.
It was, and, you know, and it's that. And then all of a sudden, you know, a lot of young, you know, musicians who aspire to do this ask me, how do you get in? And it's the chicken and the egg thing. Nobody knows. You have to have a hit for these label heads to entrust you with the money and these projects. Because no, the answer, the truth is that nobody really knows. We just, if we batten in our 300s, we're going to be in the Hall of Fame, you know.
But talk about Blue Apron for 1 second. This October, Blue Apron is celebrating its 5th anniversary by bringing back its top 20 recipes from throughout the past 5 years, as picked by you, the Blue Apron community. Did you know this, Lunchbox? For bringing back the top ones?
I did not know that.
What's your very favorite one, if you had to pick one?
Oh, man, I can't even... I like the enchiladas.
Yeah, you get a lot of enchiladas?
A lot of enchiladas and tacos, and their pizza's really good. If you've ever had their pizza, the dough is so good. Now that you say that, I don't have a favorite. I'm just going to start naming every one of them.
Your favorite Blue Apron recipes are back on the menu for a limited time only. Blue Apron is all about giving people fresh recipes, and you can explore new things. And this is why that they don't repeat recipes, but now they're doing this where they're bringing back their all-time customer favorites. Go to blueapron.com/bobbycast. blueapron.com/bobbycast. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron deliver them right to your door. They give, tell you how to make it. $30 off your first meal with free shipping. blueapron.com/bobbycast. A better way to cook. blueapron.com/bobbycast. All right, so you work with Lone Star, and that was the one where at least you said, hey, here's my resume, and it's quite big now because I did the Lone Star record. How many songs on Lone Star records did you do? Oh, did you do all of it?
Yeah, that was that record. I can't remember the title. Lonely Grill. It was the record, and there's a bunch of hits off that thing.
So, to a producer, because we move into the producer part for my listeners that don't know exactly what a producer does, because luckily I do, and I didn't until I started going into the studio myself and seeing the producer pretty much has to hear and see everything. Mm-hmm. So now you're not just playing guitar. You're putting keys on things. Like, what is it, in your mind, how would you describe a record producer?
But it's the person that gets it done. I mean, there's no set way to do it. I mean, I worked for great producers who were not musicians even, who couldn't talk in terms of musical language. They couldn't tell you which chord to play or whatever, but they knew how to put teams together. I'm obviously a musician, so it's kind of like being a player coach, you know, that type of thing. And it helps me cast. I'm a real believer in casting. You know, you don't put. I learned probably more about how to produce by working with producers who, you know, I was on the receiving end of some of their mistakes. You know, you get somebody cast who's not the right person to play, and you're kind of, you know, pistol whipping him into doing something that he doesn't know how to do. You don't do that. You know, you play to people's strengths, and so knowing who does what and who does what really well is a good you know, leg up in it. And I know how to communicate. I usually don't like to play guitar while I'm producing. I usually do it after the fact in the overdub scenario, just because it's hard to. When I sit and play guitar, I'm a guitar player. I can't help it. That's kind of who I am. And sometimes I will do it, but you try to listen to the big picture. You're supposed to be listening to that relationship between the artist, that song, and the band. So that's the big picture. And then what kind of minutiae you get into is kind of dependent on, you know, your ability and your interest. And some producers get put on the gloves and get way down deep into it. Some producers hire that out, you know, and there's no right or wrong way of doing it. But in the end, does it work? That's what the record companies care about.
My question, I guess, is, and so I go back to like the Beach Boys, for example. Whenever Brian Wilson would produce the Beach Boys, the band would go and tour, and he would have all the stuff ready for them, and you know, the Wrecking Crew. I mean, all those guys were playing. The band wasn't really playing the records, but then they would go out on tour and play all the songs.
Yeah.
Now, as a producer, are there times where you're like, you know what, I'm producing a band, but to really get a good record, I need to get players in here and not the actual band. Yes. Is that ever awkward?
Oh, it's always awkward, especially if the band. Now, in Nashville, we set up a little bit differently. It historically, it's always been. I think this town has been more of an extension of publishing, and that's the way the record business. That's my view of it. Touring is a separate entity, you know, and so it was, you know, the artists would come in with the producers, with their players, the studio players. They would do that. Record would be cut. the artists went out and did their thing with their bands, and never did the two kind of intertwine. You know,
what about a band though?
Well, that's where now all of a sudden, fast forward, you know, yeah, there are artists who is like, I want my sound. I don't want to sound like the last record, and that's really tough to do because you get these musicians, the songs. I mean, pop music, pop country. It's all it's still a pretty narrow tunnel to go through, right? It's just the pop music in general. You get the same musicians, the same songs-ish, right? And it's going to kind of sound the same-ish. So these artists have a real reason to say, I want my people. There's the rub, because sometimes it's dependent on time, ability. You know, just because you can play what's on the record doesn't mean you can create it, play it in time, and be able to move on a moment's notice. So there's always some negotiation there. As a producer, I prefer having band members from the touring crews come in, because I think that even though it takes a little bit longer sometimes, I think that gives it a little more identity.
And I would never ask you to name anyone, but has there been a situation where a whole band that we would know as a band, where the lead singer was the only, because the band just didn't have the chops, but the lead singer sang and the rest of the guys were studio players?
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's a common. That's really a common thing. Even absolutely. Though that's they're the real band, like that's
absolutely
the whole.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it just, and again, it. You know, I mean, I understand somewhere. I mean, again, I've worn both hats. I've been a player on these things. The first two records of Rascal Flatts, I played guitar on those records. I was one of the, you know, Joe Don Rooney's a great guitar player. And first song that we did, yeah. That's my first song that I produced with them. And Mark Bright, Marty Williams produced the first two records. They were great. They had God Bless the Broken Road on it. I mean, this is great stuff. It was more studio players. I think Jay played a little bit on those records. He may have played a little bit more. I probably don't have all my research, but I remember that we were all in there playing. And I kept looking at Joe Don, dude, you need to play these things. And so when they decided to make a change and they called me, that was the big thing. You know, I got Joe Don playing all that stuff. I mean, that's him now. Some of the rhythm parts I played or I would hire that out. But he was always there playing. All the solos were Joe Don from that moment on.
Those guys, pretty proficient all the way around?
Absolutely. Jay's a great bass player. Jay's a great musician, period. I mean, there's only three of them. So, and I think now, I mean, I still used other studio players. I mean, you know, I mean, I didn't use their road crew. And to their credit, Jay, who is producing their records now, and they're great, really good records, I think he's using Jim Riley, their drummer, who's a great drummer. So, you know, I mean, producers get, you know, you get comfortable. They expect you to deliver, the record label. And the band actually expects you to deliver. As long as you're having hits, you're in, right? So there is that, I think you said it, it's just awkward and uncomfortable, and you kind of got to navigate those situations.
With it only being three guys, but those three guys can play.
Yeah, well, Gary doesn't play. I mean, he sings.
Well, but he can play that voice.
He plays that voice.
Gary doesn't play at all.
I do have a great story about that song. This is, and I don't think they will mind it, me telling this story, but this is a great story. And this is just the beauty and the recklessness and craziness of these guys, you know. So I think the first song that I did with them when they said they're going to make a producer change, it was, I think we recorded the song Life is a Highway for that Cars.
Yeah.
So it was great. And everybody's in there. We did that. And it was like we really nailed it. I mean, doing a cover song sometimes scary. Anyway, so and it was going to be, well, in a month and a half, we're going to start the record. And it was great. And, you know, very loose. And the guys are touring all the time. So we show up in the studio. And this is out in Franklin. And we're going to cut What Hurts the Most that night. Right. So we show up. And I think we're going to start at 7 o'clock. And it's about 8 o'clock. And I asked Jay, I said, hey, so when's Gary going to show up? And just without missing a beat, Jay goes, oh, he's not coming. I said, huh? He said, no, he's hunting. This is whatever season. I don't know what you shoot right now, right? You know, but there is a kind of a season, right? And he acted like, you know, well, duh. I mean, everybody knows that Gary's not going to show up during hunting season. And I'm sitting there going, well, I didn't get the memo. I mean, I'm assuming that we need a singer to sing this song that we've never, you guys have never. And Jay goes, hold on. Hit a key, goes, about that key. That'll be about, that's where Gary sings. And that was it. So we just cut the track. Is that bizarre? And, of course,
Gary that's so funny about Gary, because Gary lives in the woods when Gary's not in the woods. Like, I know that about Gary now. Like, Gary lives in the woods when he's not in the woods.
Unapologetically. And, you know, that's his right. That's what it's sacred for him. I get it. I was a little thrown off at first, but, you know.
Because you're producing a record without a singer.
Well, yeah, you'd think, you know. But now there was presence, because I mentioned I used to play on records without singers. So, okay, we can do this. But it took me about 15 minutes to get my head kind of.
When does Gary show up to do the vocals then?
Like, whenever he wanted to. Whenever it wasn't hunting season. You know, I mean, he would come in and he'd just come over to the house and you know, he'd have his chewing tobacco, you know, point me in the direction. He'd just go in there and wail. And, you know, just does what he does. He's beautifully, naive is not the right word, detached in a lot of ways. He is such a pure talent. And he just does it when he does it. You know, he's not like a guy who likes to be in the studio. And there's a freshness about it. It takes a little while to get used to it, but I love that story. And that song was a massive part in kind of another validation for me as a producer here in town.
How about this one? Losing him is blue like I never. So you work with Taylor.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's she like to work with as an artist?
She's great. I mean, that song, and I'm trying to think how that came down. I think that was kind of in her transition era, and they weren't roping that, and so I think she'd already done the vocals, and Scott Borchetta said, I don't think she's going to come in and re-sing. I think you're going to have to use that, but could you recut the track?
So she had already cut the vocals somewhere else.
Yes.
And so they just give that to you and say, make the song happen.
Yes. Yeah, it was a little bit bizarre. They just want, you know, and this happens to all of us. This is a tough thing, and it just happened to me just recently too. You know, sometimes you don't get it, you know, and the label and the artist really think that this song is the deal. They got to get it done, and you know, sometimes you look at a painting so close, that's how it is to you, and you can't. And her producer at that time, Nathan Chapman, who is
Nathan, yeah,
this guy is. Genius level. I think he's one of the best that we got here in Nashville, and he's one of the best people I know too. So it was tough on Nate, and he was so pro about it. He was so cool, and he just sent me over the vocals. He said, hey, have a go at this thing, man. You know, he said, I'm looking at it. It's too close for me, and so I took it, and you know, had a different kind of take on it, and went and did it.
And so you send it. Since she already sent you the vocals, did you work with her, or did you just work with her voice that was in a recorded little?
Well, mostly on that, the voice had been recorded. I can't remember if I did, it was a while back, so I can't remember if I redid harmony vocals or what. I remember she came over to the house once to re-sing a couple of lines that I wanted to try, and that was basically it. She's great. I mean, she's Taylor Swift.
You say you missed, what did you miss on? You say you missed recently. What did you miss?
It was, you want me to tell you the story?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I missed, but I was doing a song with Keith and it was, you know, and because of my, I guess my age, my status in the industry, I inherit a lot of projects like this and I see the pain in the producers that have worked their ass off basically to get this stuff right. And all of a sudden they're calling in this old geezer, you know, to fix it. And so, and it's hurtful. It just really is. It's a business, right? And usually I know how to finish. I'm a really good finisher on this stuff. So I get it, you know, and it doesn't happen to me a lot. I will say that, but the other day I was doing a song with Keith and actually Ross Copperman and I were doing it together. And I think we did a really good job, but just Keith heard it differently. And he took it somewhere else. So it's like, you get a little, you know, you got to learn how to take it. I mean, this is, you know, you get benched in pro sports, you get benched in music. I mean, you know, as a player, they erase my parts at times. And it's one thing that you get it intellectually, but you still, it hurts. You never get used to getting replaced on something. It just happens, yeah.
You mentioned Keith and Ross, and I'll hit this one here because in different ways they were both involved in this with you. I'm telling you. Blue Ain't Your Color.
Yeah, yeah.
Ross wrote, if I'm right, because Ross is a friend of mine. Didn't Ross
write that one?
Didn't Ross
I don't
write
think,
this?
No, he actually, he writes one of the only hits in Nashville that Ross didn't write.
Okay, so Stephen Lee Olsen wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you produce with Ross?
No, I did, Keith and I did.
So Ross had nothing to do with the song? No. I'm just giving Ross every hit, for every credit for every hit I guess there is.
That's great. No, it's good. No, actually he didn't on that one, but you know. You know what I think about Ross. He's
Stephen Lee Olson.
Stephen Lee Olson.
Hillary Lindsey, and Clint Lagerberg.
Lagerberg. Sorry about that, Ross. I gave you extra credit. So, but this is you. You produced this song here. I'm telling you. Which, when Keith comes to you and says, hey, I want a song to feel a certain way, does he do that on this song and go, hey, I need it to feel, and then what does that song feel like?
With Keith and I go back to Somebody Like You, right? And it was bizarre. I mean, I don't think he wanted to work with me at first because he didn't like the records that I was producing. But it worked out. That was the first song that we actually did together. And then, I don't know how many, we did like six records straight. And now I work with him. I don't do all of his records. I mean, you know, there's a certain amount, you know, you kind of squeeze the fruit, and that's, you know, you can only get so much. But we keep returning because there's something that we have. And it's really undefinable, Bobby. I don't know how to tell you. Like, when Keith and I get in a room, that we usually do no prep. He'll just play me a song and go, what do you think? Yeah. And we usually pick up guitars.
You ever say no?
On Keith, it's never worked out where I haven't been able to do it. No, interesting song on that same record. The first single I did with him, Ross wrote it. He didn't produce it, but he, the John 3:16 song, the John Deere.
Yeah, John Deere, John Cougar, John Deere, John 3:16.
And I think actually Keith took that one to Nathan Chapman first. And I think Nathan just was like, it was a totally different song at that point. And Nate just said, you know, I just don't hear it, which is fine, you know. And so Keith called me up. I was second calling that one, you know. And we went in the studio, and I think it was a drummer and Keith and I. That was it. And the bass player was going to come in, and the bass player hadn't shown up yet. And we were just kind of strumming through ideas. I grabbed a guitar, started playing something. He said, "Oh, I dig that. Is there a bass here?" So he grabbed the bass, and all of a sudden, the identity of the song happened that quickly when he played bass. Poor bass player came in right on time for his big Keith Urban session. I think it was his debut session. And I had to say to the bass player, hey, I think we got the bass part.
It was Keith.
Yeah, it was Keith. But it was really good. You know, Keith always thought we were going to replace it, but it had so much personality. All that to say, with Keith and I, we have no set way of doing things. I mean, a lot of times he'll come over to the house, or I'll go over to his house. We hand guitars back and forth. You know, and we have a certain understanding as guitar players, and songs just kind of emanate out of that, you know?
Urban, as a player, where would he be in this studio session world if he decided to be a studio player?
Keith is a great musician. He's a great guitar player. He has an identity, which doesn't necessarily translate into studio work. Because studio, sometimes it's the ability to take on different identities. So the talent, I don't think Keith reads. His musical IQ is off the charts, so he could adapt to anything. How that would translate in day-to-day session work, I don't know.
I guess it's a different linear versus non-linear mindset.
Yeah, totally. And it's not. And it's,
I never thought about it like that before.
Yeah, I mean, it's like. Yeah, it's like the idea that the foolishness of saying who's the best drummer, who's the best guitar player in the world. How can you compare, you know, how could you compare a Keith Richards to an Andre Segovia? You can't. That comparison, they both play guitar, but it's a different world.
Have you seen play as a player, like a fan, that's not, where you're just like, man, I could never do that, like that you've seen with your own eyeballs, and you're like, there's no way.
I'm humbled like that all the time. I mean, there's a lot of things I can do, just because I practice so much in my life. I mean, there were some like jazz players like Joe Pass. I could never play like that. I couldn't chicken pick like Brent Mason does on some of those records in the 90s, those Alan Jackson records. I could play the notes, but they wouldn't sound like that. So it's more like. It's not that physically I can't do those things. It's like that I know they'll never sound that good.
Artist-wise, who have you been blown away by with their style and how good they were? Like they really are as legit as we see them. Like you mentioned Keith Richards. I don't know if you've ever seen Keith play, person.
Yeah.
When you see Keith Richards play, what do you see?
The soundtrack to my life. I mean, it's not that what Keith can do I couldn't do when I was 12 years old, or 10 for that fact. I mean, it's not that hard to do. But to do it like he does it, that's a lifetime, and nobody can do it but him. Keith has really, I think, developed into that soul as a musician. He speaks. I think the highest compliment I could pay to Keith is that when you hear him play guitar, you know it's Keith Urban. And I think that identity, that's very hard to achieve. It's a different scale than a studio musician who's having to wear 10 hats maybe in the course of a week.
What about like a guy like a John Mayer?
Oh, he's stunning. Stunning. Great. He's like a student of guitar. I mean, it's like, and his identity changes quite a bit. I mean, he's rhythmically, his chops are first rate. He can play Jeff Beck almost like Jeff Beck, and that's a pretty high compliment because that's my favorite guitar player. He's a blues aficionado. I mean, he can play pretty much anything, and he plays it legit.
Prince?
Totally underrated. Totally underrated. I underrated him even in the 80s. I didn't realize how great of a rhythm guitar player and a lead guitar player he was. Fearless, too.
Tom Petty?
You can't extract that from the identity of his music. Great in the sense that it's when he defined a genre in the way he plays. I wouldn't say he's not a shredder. He couldn't do that. He's not a guy that would blow you away with his soloing. But I don't think you can take the guitar away from Tom Petty. He is that with the guitar.
What about the guys? And I'm just asking you. Obviously, we talked about none of this, but I guess someone like Dimebag Darrell from like Pantera.
Yeah.
Who I watch him and I'm just like, holy crap. And that's a different kind of guitar.
Yes, yeah.
But when you see, I don't even know what that is called. And it's metal, but is that trash metal, heavy metal? But when you watch him, like Dimebag Darrell, is that a guy you look at and go, man, that guy could play?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in that genre, I mean, again, you know, it's like in that style of music, he was as legit as it came. And it flowed from him. If you like music, you don't even like the style, but you know when it's true. And the way he played was staggeringly good. There's a lot of great guys from that era.
Why Jeff Beck for you?
Man, he makes a guitar. I the best way I can say it is I took Sherry, my wife. Sherry does not like instrumental music. And I took her down to a show down in Atlanta one time. Actually, Joe Don Rooney had us come down with him. And took my wife, who would never watch a guitar player in her life. She thinks guitar solos are a waste of time.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. That's who you'd be married
to.
Of course.
Yeah. And it was since we were 20. So so I've been tutored on that. So my guitar solos are very succinct these days. But I took her down to the show and she was enraptured because he's so lyrical. It's not about chops. He speaks. It's like a human voice. And it's, I mean, you know, when he's 70, something like that. And he still plays as good as he ever did. He does stuff that again, you could sit and do, but you could never do and sound like him, you know?
As a producer now, what's your lockdown on music not getting leaked? Because
it was actually scarier in the early 2000s because we were still making CD copies and a lot of stuff was getting leaked by you know, temp workers at the studios and whatnot. Right now, I don't send out stuff. I mean, people come to me and I just keep it on my hard drives, my computer. That's it. You know, and if I send stuff out, I'll send them something like an MP3 on their iMessage.
You know, you'll do that though. Like you don't worry that, I don't know, the Russians or anybody.
I don't know if Russians like country music. Yeah.
They like money though. I would.
In the pop, I remember there was, I guess there's a certain protocol. I remember Justin Bieber was doing a song with Rascal Flatts, and I remember I apparently made the mistake of sending an MP3 via email to one of the New York record labels so they could sign off on this thing. And I got reprimanded royally. We do it this way. It's encrypted. You know, it's like, whatever. Okay, I got it. Maybe we're a little slower here, and they haven't figured out, you know. With new artists, it doesn't matter because nobody knows who they are. Like, there's a lot of new artists, you know. Like, when you're doing, you know, so I got about three or four new artists. You've probably heard of them because you're pretty close to the pulse of what's going on in town. But for the most part, nobody's going to know who these people are. And it's some pretty significant music. It doesn't matter. And it's floating around until there's, but when it's a star, it takes on a little different dimension.
Tell me about this one. So we talked about you producing Some Heart, Carrie Underwood here. Now, did you produce with Carrie? Was she in the studio with you?
Yes.
Because I've seen her sing in a studio and it's like, she's like, man, she's on it.
Oh man, she makes you look like a genius. I mean, you love singers like that. Carrie is who she is. I didn't do any of the country stuff. That was a weird story on that one. I ended up doing the stuff that they that was not country, which is you know, which is heartbreaking to me because I knew she was going to be a country star. That's that's kind of water under the bridge. But like there's a young artist named Rachel Womack right now who you probably haven't heard of her. She's so new, but she's in that league, totally thin air, right? I mean, and she comes into the studio and just sings a pass. I mean, normally you're working on this stuff for days. And it's like you just sit there and go, God, there is a God. Somebody is looking out after me. It just makes you get past the technical side of making records and just you're just on to making music. So
because what it is so big. It's like the technical because I'm there's greatness right here.
Yes.
And it's
And
it's so big.
Yeah. And not everything is like that. And you know what? Not every song is made like that. And there's some significant songs that are made that are work pieces. There was a song years ago that Keith and I did that I think was so significant. It was called, what's the one? I'm horrible on titles. I've always been, Rodney Crowell wrote Making Memories. I don't know if you know that song.
I do know that song.
Great lyric. It's something that Keith didn't write, but he was fanatical about getting the song right because he didn't write it. He wanted to honor the writer. We must have recorded that song 7 different ways. And it's not that Keith, I mean, Keith comes sing it in one take too. But we were trying to get to the essence of that song. It's so simple. It sounds like you could have done it in 10 minutes. That song was probably the hardest song we've ever been a part of. So you never know what you're getting into in this stuff.
Let me give you a couple scenarios. Scenario one, you have an artist. You really couldn't hit it with them. It just didn't work. So they went somewhere else and they were huge successful. And they worked with somebody else. Mm-hmm. Who would that artist be?
Carrie Underwood. Totally. I mean, that was a heartbreaker for me. You know, it was, and it went to a dear friend of mine. So Mark Bright, it's as it should be, you know, but it was one of those situations. I knew I was being teed up by Clive Davis to do these songs. He thought she should be a pop artist. That was like a Diane Warren song there. And I knew what Carrie was going to declare and I wasn't going to, hey, well, she wasn't going to be a pop artist, but I was recording these songs that were not going to do anything. I just knew it, you know? So that was a tough one. But
who was it that you heard then that, you know, had been around and just, but you were like, I think I got these guys or girls like who, that you were like, man, let me have a shot at them. And you actually broke through with them because of how together you gelled.
You know, I've really never actually, I've been lucky, Bobby. Most people, I haven't solicited gigs. It just, they usually come towards me, which is bizarre. I'm trying to think if there's anybody that I remember at one point 10, 12 years ago that I called Scott Burchett and I said, hey, why don't you call me for your new label? And he laughed. He said, I thought you were too expensive. And so that was like a call like that. And that led to a bunch of these things.
You are pretty expensive.
Well,
you are pretty expensive. Listen, I hear how much it is aside. I know you are. Listen,
it's worth it.
You ain't hungry, Dan. You also did a lot with TR Thomas on his last record.
Oh man, yeah, he's special. I mean, you know that record. The stuff that got left on the cutting room floor on that record.
You think there were two records there?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, that's hard to market, you know, but it's so freaking good.
How do you work with another producer? Because you co-produce songs.
You know what? And I think that's kind of the new thing. I mean, I'm at the old end of this game here. I mean, and I know my worth. I know what I bring to the table. But I'm not 28 years old. You know, I mean, I'm not 30, and so I have to look through the lens of younger people. I mean, it's really important. And I saw the greats. Quincy Jones was a guy who really made that very obvious. You know, you want to stay in the game. You can't let your pride dictate, you know, how you're going to make your music. So it's really reinvented me. Being Jesse Frazier, you met him the other night. And I mean, you know, and all those guys, they hear music a different way. And then I kind of put what I do on top of that or underneath it, whatever, you know.
And I'm sure with two people calling shots at times, there's got to be a sort of a power struggle, right? If you have two bosses.
You'd think, you know, no.
Really?
No. I mean, maybe because I'm so much older, you know, it doesn't seem that way. And
you're 100, Dan. You keep acting like you're this old.
You're younger than me.
And you're talking about you have all your hair. It's just not long.
Well, you know, but in musical years, dog musical years, I'm 2000, you know, I'm Methuselah, but No, it's it. We I, so far, you know, it's like sometimes you have a difference of opinion, but you know, it's like I'm not dictatorial in the way I do things, and it's weird because I do enough co-production. You know, work with Julian and Joe on that record too. I didn't know Julian that well, so
and Julian done a bunch of One Direction stuff and a bunch of pop stuff, LA stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and he has his direction, you know, and sometimes it's just learning, kind of getting your dance coordination. But then I'll end up doing, you know, it's like, so I'll do that. And I think, well, that's going to kind of be my lot. I'm going to be that dude in the co-production thing. And then I end up working with Kane Brown and that's totally something that you wouldn't put me with, you know, and that's going stunningly well all of a sudden. That was a real gift. Yeah, obviously for Kane, you know, what he's doing. It's just all of a sudden taking off like a rocket. It's bizarre. So, I don't know how my production career is going to be even in a year from now. It just is kind of what it is.
If you lower your rate, the Raging Idiots will hire you. You need to lower it. Like, we'll hire you like a tenth. Pro bono. Pro bono.
I'd do the pro bono thing just to hang out with you one night. I think that... Yeah, I don't know if I'd have much to offer there.
Yeah, okay.
Eddie, he means everything.
Eddie's been sitting by watching. Anything you want to ask?
Gosh,
Dan?
I've been just learning a lot and taking it all in. I'd like to do something kind of like a prediction. You know what's out there right now in our format right now. Like, what's a prediction for you that like people need to look out for? This artist wise.
There's right now sitting at the studio. I'm getting ready to go back today. There's a young guy named Ryan Falaze.
I know Ryan.
Yeah. And, you know, he's trying to find his way in here. I think we got this one song that's going to do something. It really hits. There's this young artist, Rachel Womack, who I was speaking about a minute ago. She's a lightning bolt. I don't know. She's from Muscle Shoals. Doesn't know anything about country music at all. She's Southern as a banjo, you know. And she has a soul. I mean, there's something about this girl that's riveting.
Is it for you with working with Ryan? Because I know Ryan, and yeah. Ryan did the pop punk stuff for a while. Yeah. Okay, so I mean that right there is a challenge. Mm-hmm. How do you transition that without people going, "Okay, come on"? Like you got to find, like you said, you got to find that spot where it still feels natural.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and you got to you know, country music is a huge tent. I mean, which is sweet. You know, it's like it doesn't have to be one certain way. I think with him, I came in on the back end of the record he had already done. Same thing, kind of a closer. They needed some credibility, I guess. And this, the record was really good, but it was extremely pop leaning. And I don't know if he'd quite found his voice. And as a result of that, I don't think they released the whole record yet. So we went in and cut a couple songs. And I think we found that kind of nice contrast, that juxtaposition of kind of how he sings. He's a great singer and kind of that soul and you know, words, I have a hard time describing this words. You just kind of fiddle with this stuff until all of a sudden it feels true. And he's got a song called Love Will Do That to You, which I think is really powerful. You know,
I hear the producer's pretty good. That's word on the street. I don't know. I just hear stuff on the streets. Just on the streets. So I really appreciate you coming in. Like, you won a couple CMAs for Producer of the Year. Like, you got it. You act like you got nothing. And you got it all. Like, I tell you, there was the one guy geeked. There were people everywhere. And I was like, I got to get a picture with Dan. So, like, I'm a huge fan. So the fact that you would come in and talk to me for an hour, I really appreciate that.
Are you kidding? I mean, you guys, you stepped into some massive shoes here, too. I mean, this, you know the history of this town.
I do.
I know your ability, and you have stepped into them and commanded it. So congratulations to
thanks.
You.
Also the same old equipment, luckily for me. They won't even upgrade the facilities, as you can see.
This old is school.
This
I love
this
it.
Is Jerry House's old equipment here on the man. Board. So let me say this real quick. You can search for the Whiskey Riff, episode 33. They're doing a State of the Union on the country format where they talk about Vegas and producer Anna sits down with Hunter Hayes. And so you can check out the Whiskey Riff podcast. Just search for that on iTunes or iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to podcasts. But that's going to be it for us here. Dan, I really appreciate you coming in. Thanks. I know I said it like 84 times already, but I'm a huge fan. If you ever need anything, you ever need a new year, fresh year, you ever need a fresh year, you let me know. It's been really great. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Bobby.
We'll see you guys next time here. Bobbycast.